Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY2, a radiology resident. I guess I better stop saying PGY1, TY resident, going into radiology. So actually, I'm now, as of yesterday, I am now a PGY2 radiology resident. So welcome to episode 117 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This will be a USMLE Step 1 Rapid Review Series. This will be series 9, and I'm going to be focusing on repro today. So let's just get right into it. So what is the most common benign breast neoplasm? That's a fibroadenoma, right? That's a fibroadenoma. So it will present as like a 30-20-something-year-old lady has this singular mobile breast mass that kind of hurts a little and kind of seems to grow with the menstrual cycle. You're not supposed to do any diagnostic testing. You're not supposed to do any treatment. Now, what if you get a bloody nipple discharge in a young female or any female at all on an MBME exam? What are you thinking about? That's an introductal papilloma, right? Okay. Now, what if you have a hard mass, a hard breast mass in a woman that previously got into a fight? That's fat necrosis, right? That's fat necrosis. Okay. What if you get a question about fever in a woman with a baby, you know, kind of tugging on her nipple like 3 days ago? Or let's say it's like a postpartum female. And I'll actually talk about this in a podcast that I'm going to make right after this. It will probably be my shortest podcast ever, maybe like a 5-6 minute podcast. But it's just something that a lot of people get wrong. So people have just said, Divine, can you just make a podcast just for this? It's differentiating between some breast pathologies that people seem to get wrong quite a bit on USMLE exams. So I'll just make it as a separate, like literal, like 5 minute podcast. I'll make it right after this. Okay. So this question I was referring to is mastitis, right? Acute mastitis. Okay. Now, what are the 3 diagnostic criteria for PCOS? Right. So one will be signs of anovulation, right? So like irregular menses kind of deal. Right. What's the ultrasound criteria? Polycystic ovaries on ultrasound, right? And then they will have signs of hyperandrogenism, right? So like the hirsutism and all that stuff. Okay. Now, what is the most common cause of a breast mass in a female in the US? That's fibrocystic change, right? Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a 50-something-year-old female and they tell you that, oh, her nipples look like scaly and have like eczematous changes? What are you thinking about? I hope you're saying Paget's disease. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a lady, and this will be a classic thing they'd love to do on the USMLE Step 1. They talk about a lady, you know, has a small mass that was detected on mammogram, and then they say they took a biopsy, and on histology, they're seeing like nuclear with like central clearing, and they tell you that, oh, they did some studies on these cells, and they have an EEC adhering mutation. What are you thinking about? That's lobular carcinoma in situ, right? Or invasive lobular carcinoma. Remember, the lobular carcinomas, for some reason, tend to have those cadherin mutations. Remember, cadherin is one of those things that holds epithelial cells together. And remember, right, that people that have lobular carcinoma in situ, they have a high risk of bilateral breast cancer. Okay. Now, what is the drug of choice in the treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer? That's trastuzumab, right? Remember, trastuzumab is a monoclonal antibody against the HER2. And remember that it can cause a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy. So a classic USMLE question may be, prior to beginning trastuzumab therapy, what is the next best step in management? And your answer for that patient will want to be to get an echocardiogram, to get a baseline ejection fraction, right? And remember that your drugs like doxorubicin, donorubicin, those drugs can also cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, but remember it's an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. It's actually kind of high yield to know that for tests. Okay, now, what if they tell you that a person has like a testicular tumor, and on histology, they tell you that you are seeing like eosinophilic colored rods, like pink rods in like testicular cells? What are you thinking about? What kind of tumor are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about like the Leydig cell tumors, right? Remember, those are the Ranke crystals, okay? Now, what if they tell you that you see cells with a fried egg appearance on histology and it relates to like a repro malignancy? What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about seminomas in like a testicular seminomas, I hope you're also thinking about those coilocytes, right, that you find with HPV infection. And then don't forget the brain tumor oligodendroglioma can also have a fried egg appearance on histology. Okay, and what's the most common germ cell tumor in guys? That's a seminoma, right? Okay, now what if a person has like an ovarian mass and they tell you that, oh, her beta HCG is markedly elevated? What are you thinking about? That's a choriocarcinoma. Remember, choriocarcinoma can also happen in guys, right? Okay. Now, what's the tumor marker that, if elevated, can basically help you rule out a seminoma? That's an elevated AFP, right? Elevated alpha fetoprotein. If the alpha fetoprotein is what is elevated on an MBME exam, do not choose seminoma. It cannot be seminoma on an MBME exam. What's the tumor that, what's the ovarian mass that classically has an elevated AFP? That's a yolk sac tumor, right? That's a yolk sac tumor. Sometimes on the MBME, they call that an endodermal sinus tumor. Okay. And what are the classic findings on histology in a person that has a yolk sac tumor? They kind of look like small glomeruli. Those are the Shiller-Duvall bodies, right? These are the Shiller-Duvall bodies, okay? And for most ovarian cancers, right? So is there like a tumor marker for most ovarian cancers? That's CA125, right? Okay. Now, this thing is, I'm going to focus on epidemiology for a short while, but they love to test this stuff on the USMLEs. What is the most common cause of gynecologic-related, like gyn cancer-related deaths? What's the most common cause? That's ovarian cancer, right? Okay. What is the second most common cause of gyn malignancy-related deaths? That's endometrial cancer, right? Okay. And what is the most commonly diagnosed gynecologic cancer in women? So gynecologic, I don't mean like, technically by gynecologic, I don't include breast, right? But most commonly diagnosed gynecologic cancer in women, that's endometrial cancer, right? Okay. Ovarian cancer is number two on that list. Okay, now, so let's assume you get a question about a person that, they have a history of a Kahn syndrome from like bilateral adrenal hyperplasia. So obviously you cannot do a bilateral adrenalectomy for those people. And then the guy tells you that let's say you start the guy on a drug. And then 4 weeks later he says, "Doc, I cannot take this drug anymore. He's complaining of like side effects with his breast." What kind of drug are you thinking about? And what side effect am I getting after? Well, I hope you're thinking about spironolactone, right? Remember, spironolactone can cause gynecomastia, right? Remember, it's an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right? So it also causes like a metabolic acidosis, and it causes like hyperkalemia, right? Remember, it's a potassium sparing diuretic. Remember, it can cause gynecomastia because in addition to blocking aldosterone receptors, it also has the ability to block androgen receptors, right? If you want to prevent that gynecomastic side effect, you probably want to go with eplerenone. Eplerenone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist, but it has no blockade of androgen receptors. Okay, now, what if you get a question on the MBMEs about a lady that has a BMI of like 35, and she has her menses every 45 days, and anytime she has her menses, she has like very heavy menses, and let's assume herself and her husband have been trying for a while to have kids, not working out so well. What kind of drug would you want to give that patient? You'd want to give her clomiphene, right? Why is that? Because she has PCOS, right? You want to regularize her menstrual cycles, okay? Because clomiphene, right? It's a SERM. If you notice, it sounds eerily similar to like tamoxifen, raloxifen, clomiphene. It's a SERM. So the thing is, it has partial estrogen receptor agonist activity in the brain. So by being a partial agonist, right, it's basically acting as an antagonist. So it's essentially almost creates like some kind of like, it kind of like removes negative feedback of estrogen at the level of the brain, right? So that increases the HPG axis pulsatility, and that increases the lady's risk of fertility. In fact, I can't quote exact numbers, but I know I've read a study where a lot of women that had PCOS, most of them that were placed on clomiphene actually got pregnant. Okay, now, what if you want, what's like the drug of choice in general? If a person has PCOS and let's assume they're not necessarily having plans to have a kid soon or anything like that, they just want to regularize their cycles. What do you give them on MBMEs? You give them OCPs, right? You give them OCPs. Okay, now, what is the drug that can be used to treat hirsutism on MBME exams in patients that have PCOS? You can actually use spironolactone, right? And the reasoning behind that is that spironolactone has an ability to inhibit 5-alpha reductase in the skin. Okay, remember, 5-alpha reductase converts testosterone to DHT. Spironolactone in the skin can inhibit 5-alpha reductase. So you may say, Divine, this is super low-yield crap. I promise you, again, obviously I can't say much, but I promise you that it's not super low-yield crap to know. Because one thing your friends on the MBME love to do is they love to test the peripherally related concept about, they can basically give you a question about like a lady that's like in her 30s and she's hirsute, but you're like, man, this lady's BMI is fine, so she doesn't have PCOS. And this lady doesn't have any adnexal masses, so she doesn't have like an androgen secreting tumor, anything like that. And they will show you that, oh, the FSH is normal, LH is normal, testosterone is normal, everything is normal. If you ever see that, you really want to think about a person that has increased activity of 5-alpha reductase. That's something that is found in certain populations of people where they just having, they're completely normal, they have no issues going on, but they just have increased activity of 5-alpha reductase. This is one of those things that I can promise you. If you're a second year med student or you're a student preparing for step one, between now and the time you graduate from med school, you're going to see this concept tested at least 3 times. I can pretty much guarantee that. So it's something you better keep at the back of your mind. Okay. So the reason I'm saying that is, right, again, increased activity of 5-alpha reductase can make you hirsute, right? So if a person has hirsutism in the setting of PCOS, it should make sense that you want to give them a skin 5-alpha reductase inhibitor like spironolactone. Okay, now, what if you get a question about like a 70-year-old guy? He comes in, he says over the last 6 months, he's been having like urinary dribbling and he occasionally has like urinary urgency. First off, what's your diagnosis for this guy? That's BPH, right? Benign prostatic hyperplasia. And then what's your next step in management of this patient's symptoms? So acutely, like to relieve his symptoms like relatively quickly, what do you want to do? You would want to give an alpha-1 blocker, right? An alpha-1 blocker like prazosin or doxazosin, right? But remember that those drugs can cause orthostatic hypotension because the alpha-1 receptor blockers. So on the exam, the drug you probably want to go with is tamsulosin. Tamsulosin inhibits the alpha-1-AD receptor. So by inhibiting the alpha-1-AD receptor, it only targets the bladder neck. It doesn't target your blood vessels, okay? And a very nice question they can actually throw on an MBME exam is to basically present a question about a person that has a BPH, right? And then let's assume it's a person that maybe has some history of another disease that makes them take a vasodilator like a nitrate, or they are taking like hydralazine or like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? Those people have a relative contraindication to an alpha-1 blocker, right? Because that can cause a profound drop in their blood pressures. Or they can describe a person that has BPH and is already on prazosin, for example. And then they tell you that, oh, this person also has erectile dysfunction, right? You probably want to think twice before putting them on sildenafil, because again, you, in general, I'll just tell you this as a general concept. You don't want to give people 2 vasodilators together, especially old people, because it can dilate their blood vessels profoundly. They can have very bad hypotension and they can like pass out or something. They can have like a syncopal episode. So that's a very wonderful thing your friends at the MBME love to do every now and then. Okay, now, but for the long term, how can you treat a person's BPH symptoms? How can you shrink the size of the prostate? You can give a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, right? Like finasteride or dutasteride, okay? And what happens to your levels of sex hormone binding globulin if you take OCPs or if you're pregnant? It actually goes up. It actually goes up. That's just one of those factors you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question and they tell you that they see a string of pearls in the ovaries of a 30-something-year-old female on ultrasound, and this lady has a BMI of 40. That's PCOS, right? Okay. And what is the gynecologic malignancy that a person with PCOS has an increased risk of? That's endometrial carcinoma, right? Because remember, right, people tend to be hyperestrogenic when they have PCOS. So if a person has a history of PCOS and they begin to have like very heavy menstrual bleeds and they're like in their late 30s or like early 40s, actually the next best step in the management of those people on NBMEs is to actually do something called an endometrial biopsy or an endometrial sampling to rule out endometrial cancer. Okay, because the classic teaching is, oh, if you see a postmenopausal woman, so more than 50 years old, and she's having vaginal bleeding, you do an endometrial biopsy to rule out endometrial cancer. That is true. But if a person has significant risk factors for hyperestrogenism, classically on NBMEs, that's PCOS, you actually want to go ahead and screen them for endometrial cancer as well, even if they are less than 50 years old. Okay, now, what if they tell you that on laparoscopy, you're seeing like chocolate-like cysts in the ovary? What are you thinking about? You're thinking about an endometrioma, right? Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a lady? So let's assume she's 25 years old and she comes in with like severe abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting. In fact, the question is almost like screaming hyperemesis gravidarum to you. And then they tell you that this lady is 15 weeks pregnant, but then they tell you that the length from the pubic symphysis to the fundus is like 25 centimeters. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about a hydatidiform mole, right? A hydatidiform mole. So this is something that's actually kind of high yield to know on NBME exams, right? So hydatidiform moles can actually, so molar pregnancy, right, pretty much. Those things can present as size being greater than dates within like the first trimester of pregnancy, like first or like early second trimester of pregnancy. And it can also present with like significant amounts of like nausea and vomiting, right? So it can kind of look like hyperemesis gravidarum on an NBME test. And one thing you want to keep in mind, right, obviously if you see that, right, you check the beta HCG. The beta HCG will usually be some crazy high number like 100, 200, 300, 400,000. And then you get an ultrasound and you'll classically see the snowstorm appearance, right? The snowstorm appearance. And really the way you treat that is with a suction curettage. And then what if they say, oh, after you've treated that with suction curettage, the lady starts complaining of shortness of breath. What's your next step in management? You want to go ahead and get a chest x-ray, right? Because that lady probably has a long Mets. Remember, molar pregnancy can turn to choriocarcinoma, right? And if it turns to choriocarcinoma, choriocarcinoma loves to metastasize to the lungs, okay? And how do we treat choriocarcinoma on NBMEs? That's with methotrexate. Okay. Now, what is the placental hormone that increases mom's risk of being diabetic during pregnancy? That's HPL, right? Human placental lactogen. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a man that's being treated for angina? So he's been chronically treated for angina, and then he dies while trying to get an erection. What are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about the combination of a nitrate and a phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitor, like sildenafil, tadalafil. Okay. Now, what if they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, let's say you have like a 60-something-year-old guy, and then they tell you that when they palpated the prostate on a digital rectal exam, they feel a mass in the peripheral zone of the prostate. What are you thinking about? That's prostate cancer, right? Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a lady, let's assume she's 57 years old, she has been on hormone replacement therapy, like estrogen like therapy since she was postmenopausal to treat like significant menopausal symptoms. She has been on like estrogen for a while, and then they tell you that over the last 3 months she has lost like 15 pounds and she's beginning to have like vaginal bleeding like a few days every week. What are you thinking about there? That's endometrial cancer, right, from unopposed estrogen. Okay. And then, what if you get a question about a lady, you know, she takes OCPs, she has only one sexual partner, and then she comes into the ED and she says that, oh, over the last 30 minutes, I've been having severe shortness of breath, and then they show you, like, some vital signs, and you see that the oxygen tension is, like, 80 millimeters of mercury in the blood. What are you thinking about? That's a PE, right? That's a PE. And remember, right, estrogen-containing contraceptives should not be given to a lady that is more than 35 years old that smokes. That's a high-yield thing you want to keep in mind for the USMLEs. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a lady? She says over the past like 4 weeks, she has been having high fevers. Let's assume this lady's in her 50s, right? So over the last 4 weeks, she's been having high fevers. She's been having like severe unilateral breast pain. And then when you do like a breast exam, you notice that her breast is hard. It's kind of like indurated, and it has a lot of like little, almost like dots on the breast. What are you thinking about? That's inflammatory breast cancer, right? Remember, basically, the cancer is super aggressive. It has involved the dermal lymphatics that run along the breast. So that's why they have that peau d'orange appearance. Okay. Now, what is the germ cell tumor that loves to spread hematogenously? That's choriocarcinoma, right? Okay. And let's see, because I don't want this podcast to be too long since it's technically a rapid review. Let's see, what else can I throw in here today? Okay, so what is the drug of choice? What is the preferred treatment regimen for endometritis on an NBME exam? That's clindamycin plus gentamicin, right? The easy mnemonic for that is ECG. Endometritis, clindamycin, and gentamicin. Okay, now what is the drug of choice in the treatment of chorioamnionitis on an NBME exam? That's ampicillin and gentamicin, right? So remember, like CAG, like the CAG repeats in Huntington's, for chorio, give amp and gent, right? So CAG and ECG, and that will help you remember those things. Okay, now what is the bug that classically causes PID on NBME exams, especially like in a sexually active young female? That would be like what? Like Neisseria gonorrhea, right? And chlamydia, right? Okay. And if a person has PID and they have like very bad mucopurulent discharge, what is the bug you're most likely thinking about? That would be Neisseria gonorrhea, right? And what if a person has like a watery discharge? Let's assume it's a guy, watery discharge from the penis, or it's a lady, watery discharge from her vagina. She has like a mild fever and stuff like that, and you suspect an STI. And then they say, oh, that you perform a, you get some of that fluid sample, you perform a Gram stain, and you do not see any bugs. What is the answer you should go after? That'll be chlamydia, right? That'll be chlamydia. Remember, chlamydia doesn't Gram stain. Chlamydia only stains well with a Gimse stain. Okay, now what's the most common cause of UTIs in the US? That's E. coli, right? What's the second most common cause? That is Staph saprophyticus, right? That's Staph saprophyticus. Okay. And what are the three things on NBMEs that classically increase a person's risk of recurring candidiasis, recurring vaginal candidiasis? One is smoking. Another is diabetes. And another one is some kind of immunodeficiency like HIV, right? And then my final question here, what is the screening guideline for cervical cancer on NBME exams? So from the age of 21, right? So you start at 21, you get a pap smear every 3 years, right? Till you hit the age of 30. When you hit the age of 30, you can also get a pap smear every 3 years, or you can get a pap smear plus HPV co-testing every 5 years, okay? But there's this thing your friends at the NBME love to do. They know everyone has obviously memorized the screening guideline. And FYI, you do actually need to know the screening guideline. So the thing is, one thing they love to do is to give you a question about a person that has HIV. A person that has HIV actually should get screened a lot more often, almost like every year, pretty much. So that three-year timeline does not apply to a person that has HIV. Because again, HIV increases your risk of it makes you more susceptible to HPV infection. And if you get HPV infection, that increases your risk of cervical cancer. Remember, the biggest risk factor for cervical cancer is history of HPV infection. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. And again, as I always do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, and Step 3 exams. And then the preclinical med school exams, the third-year shelf exams. And also, if you're a college student and you need tutoring for biochemistry, physics, organic chemistry, general chemistry, physiology, histology, all that stuff. I offer tutoring for those. And then if you're a resident, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application, I do offer one-on-one like consulting for that. I have been on the admissions committee of a top two med school for a year. So I have a lot of experience with those things. So if you need any of those things, feel free to reach out. I wish you a wonderful rest of the day. And I am really looking forward to when free agency opens tomorrow in the NBA. I really, really hope the Lakers can land Kawhi Leonard. But that's a story for another day. So have a great rest of the weekend. God bless you. Thank you.